Welcome to Climate Talk Uganda, the acronym-free podcast about all things climate change. I'm your host, Josephine Karungi, and today's episode is one that hits close to home, not just for Uganda, but for the entire development community. After several months of uncertainty, on July 1st, 2025, the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, was officially shut down. Globally, 83% of its programs were terminated, with any remaining operations being absorbed into the U.S. State Department. For Uganda, a country where USAID funded over 66% of development programs, this is more than a bureaucratic change. It is an enormous shift. From climate change adaptation to health, education, and livelihoods, USAID's footprint was vast. But what happens when that support suddenly disappears? What's left behind, and who is left behind? Today, I'm joined by Robert Bajenda, who spent over a decade working with USAID in Uganda. Prior to the shutdown, Robert was the team leader for the Environment, Climate, and Engineering Unit in the Economic Growth Office of the USAID mission in Uganda. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you so much, Josephine.
It's good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too.
When we met a couple of months ago, you explained that you were working and had been working with USAID for approximately 10 years?
Correct.
Yeah. What did your work involve?
Two key things, two or three. The first is that I was charged with the responsibility to design climate change and biodiversity conservation projects, but two, oversee the implementation of those projects in the country. And three, I did mention I had another role of climate integration lead, charged with the responsibility of supporting all the other sectors of USAID, all the other investments of USAID, to be able to analyze, assess the climate risks to those investments and plan for risk management strategies and mainstream them across those other sectors.
What did implementation of what you're just telling me now look like on the ground?
So once the projects were designed, we then awarded contracts to organizations, charged them with the responsibility to implement those projects. And the common thing was that these would be big international organizations who would then partner with the local organizations, either as partners, or subcontractors, local organizations, civil society, private sector partners, who would then directly engage with the beneficiaries. But also there were opportunities to, sometimes directly award some of the funding to government agencies, what we called G2G, government-to-government awards. Those presented other opportunities for implementation. Then those would directly engage with the beneficiaries to implement the designed activities.
So you were working with governments, with private sector NGOs,
yeah,
who would then work with the communities.
Exactly.
How involved were the communities, or how were the communities coming into this?
So on the ground, these communities, I'll use one or two project examples. One was a climate smart agriculture project that I was overseeing. So the communities would be organized, say, in form of farmer groups or farmer cooperatives, who would then be approached by these organizations and be taught how to implement climate smart agricultural practices. That's one example. The other, I'll use the biodiversity conservation example. Forestry activities, for example, protection of forestry, how we would engage the communities. There was one example of, engaging communities in securing the boundaries of central forest reserves, you would engage these private sector companies to make the concrete pillars, carry them to the sites, and then hand them over to local leaders and communities. In a participatory way, the community members would then show the survey teams, you know, where the boundaries are. They agree in a participatory manner and plant the boundary pillars, you know, to protect the forest reserves. So,
which areas in Uganda were you heavily engaged in?
Again, I'll continue to use those two project examples. The agriculture one was called the Enhancing Resilient and Adaptive Agricultural Livelihoods, implemented by the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture and the National Agricultural Research Organization, NARO. And the focus was mainly the dry cattle corridor. And then the biodiversity conservation project was called the Biodiversity for Resilience Activity, implemented by RTI International. And the main focus was highly biodiverse landscapes in the country. These included the Kidepo landscape and the Central Forest Reserve surrounding the national park, included the Lake Mburo National Park, included Makshon Falls National Park, and other selected Central Forest Reserves like Budongo and Kalinzo. And I'm using these two as examples of projects that I was overseeing directly. Yeah.
Do you miss the work?
Sorry?
Do you miss the work?
I really miss the work because I'm very passionate about biodiversity conservation and climate change adaptation and mitigation. So yes, I miss the work.
What do you miss the most?
Especially, you know, that private sector engagement component. It wasn't something very common. I was excited about it. We had begun to engage the private sector and, you know, encourage them to invest in biodiversity conservation, especially things that made business sense to them. And they were beginning to come on board. And it's really sad that we stopped where we had reached.
So everything just shut down?
Everything just shut down. We woke up one day and then we're told, hey, look, there are stop work orders. Now that means immediately stop what you're doing. Pens down.
I saw things like that on different social media platforms, mm-hmm. but I'd like to actually understand that they actually happened in that way. So Robert, you're sitting in your office.
Yeah.
And then someone walks to you or an email comes through. What happened?
Yeah. So it was mainly through emails. That's the official agency communication channel. You're being told, hey, look, let all your implementing partners know that they have been asked to stop working. And then the stop work orders came for each of those implementing partners.
But you would had an inkling that something like this was going to happen.
Yeah, but then we didn't expect it to be as drastic as it happened. And the clue arose from what the past was. If you may recall, during President Trump's first term in office, our climate funding was actually zeroed out at that time. But then, you know, it wasn't that drastic. We were still allowed to use the monies that we already had, you know, to proceed and complete smoothly what we had been doing. But this time it was so drastic, you know, whatever had been midway had to stop where it was. Nothing was allowed to proceed. That's how bad it was.
And I'm selfishly asking this question around climate.
Yeah.
You who is passionate about adaptation, mitigation, mm-hmm. and the environment, biodiversity, and so on.
Yeah.
You're sitting there and thinking, what does this mean for Uganda?
Yeah. Of course, for the country, so many implications. so many implications right from household and community level, and then upwards to the government institutions and to the economy in general. And looking at the communities who are the, you know, the very first level of beneficiaries, if you've, for example, been supporting them to adapt to the impacts of climate change, you know, you've been supporting them to be able to still continue to produce their food crops and be able to earn an income, and then suddenly you have these investments stopped, that means you're directly affecting their ability to produce food, their ability to earn an income from their farming activities. But this has implications for the higher levels, for the economy. The economy largely depends on agriculture, on farming. So that means there's a possible income, impact on the economy. To the government institutions, we've been building their capacities to be able to also respond to some of these climate-related impacts. But now, midway, we have to stop these kind of capacity-building activities. That means their own ability to deliver on their mandate and be able to respond to climate change, their capacities are affected. Yeah.
You know, for a lot of, I think people are more empathetic when it's the health sector that's affected or education or something.
Yeah.
But when it's climate, there's still all of this, we don't believe it anyway. So, that was money being wasted.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind?
So I think there was a misconception, especially amongst those other sectors, because climate change is a general development challenge, not climate, you know, as a standalone, because climate change affects all those other development sectors, be it health, be it education, be it water, be it, you know, energy industry, biodiversity itself. And so to think that climate change, you know, is not an issue for them is actually self-deception. And this is why I told you that as part of my work, what we're trying to do was to support those other sectors to be able... Excuse me.
I knew this water would come in handy. Mm.
Thank you. So that's why we chose to take that mainstreaming approach, support those other sectors to use a climate lens, screen their work and be able to see and know that climate change actually affects their sectors also. And so by doing those climate risk analyses, we were showing those sectors that, hey, look, you also actually need to plan for and budget for climate action within your own sector.
You know, when I hear that you are working with the private sector, I always ask myself, when they stopped the funding and immediately said, put your pens down, like you said, and you had to reach out to your implementing partners, some of who are the private sector and other donor agencies.
Yeah.
Did they also just put their pens down?
Yeah, they had to do that for the components that we were funding using U.S. government money. Pens down, tools down. But allow me clarify this. Why we were choosing to engage with the private sector. Reason is that if something makes business sense for the private sector, then chances are high that they are likely to sustain those investments even when they don't have U.S. government money.
I thought so.
Yeah, and so it was strategic on our side. We put in some little money to catalyze private sector investment. But believe me, and I'll use one example. So we managed to attract Porini Safaris, game watchers from Kenya. We put in about $200,000 to support an investment worth about $1 million. And Porini would be putting in about $800,000 to support the development of a community conservancy around the Kidepo National Park, an area called Lopej or Kawalakol. Now, to allow the coexistence of livestock and wildlife and tourism-related activities, borrowing the models from the Maasai Mara. And one strategy to build resilience to climate change is to diversify. If the livestock sector is not performing well because of the changing weather and climatic conditions, then, hey, look, the pastoralists have an option. And so we brought in this partner. But believe me, because it makes business sense, even when we've faced doubt, this business partner, this private sector partner, is continuing to engage with the cattle keepers around Kidepo to continue to build and develop this investment, just like the Maasai's are doing in Kenya and Tanzania.
I think that makes a lot of sense to me about why you would then engage private sector.
Yeah.
So where we saw things fall apart totally was not all with the private sector.
Yeah, where the investments were purely dependent on U.S. government funding, those were heavily affected. But this explains why we kept also encouraging government to also make sure that, government is beginning to plan for and budget for some of these kind of investments and say, hey, look, who knows? As a sustainability strategy, we continue to encourage government also to put in investments in the kind of work that we are doing so that if we face doubt in future, of course, we didn't know there was going to be this sudden cut, but there were those kind of sustainability strategies, engaging with the government also, encouraging them to put in budgetary allocations to this kind of works that we are doing so that even when we face doubt, you know, this kind of continuity. And we hope that those strategies are helping.
Continuing.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense that the person you're working with has a stake in this because then they want to protect it.
Yeah, correct.
Doesn't that say something about how we should start thinking that this is how we work with going forward?
Of course. Going forward, and this is a key message to our other development partners, but also government itself, that indeed, as part of our sustainability strategies, even when we have a development partner, it's very important, you know, to build those kind of sustainability strategies into the designs of any new programs.
Yeah.
Make sure government is, you know, putting in some kind of co-financing initially. Engage with the private sector. Engage directly with the communities. Even though we don't quantify in monetary terms what community contributions are, they're usually so big. You know, they contribute the land, they contribute the labor, they contribute the ideas. These are big contributions. Yeah.
So my boss likes to say on the project that we work on that you don't get into a partnership without seeing your way out. That people must know that this is ours to maintain, you know, when these guys are not here.
Correct.
Would you have any story that would help us understand how the communities are faring now that you've stepped away?
So, of course, I haven't gone back to the communities yet since we had the stop work orders in January. The stop work orders meant we couldn't even travel to get back to the communities we worked with. And so I may not have readily available response to that question. But my expectation is that especially for those interventions where we had built community capacity to do things themselves and things that they were seeing direct benefit from the works that we had taught them to do, they should be continuing to implement those. And I'll use one example. So we did support NARO through the IITA, the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture, to develop the new drought-tolerant and disease-resistant coffee varieties known as KR1 up to 10. And believe me, Josephine, if you went out to the market now, you would find those varieties. They are coming from the investments we made earlier. And because one approach we were taking was we didn't want to distribute these seedlings free of charge, you know, from the labs and then to the greenhouses, and we didn't want to distribute them free of charge.
Free of charge means
free
waste.
Of charge. Chances are very high that you're not going to sustain those kind of investments. But also because we wanted to engage the youth in agriculture as a business, create employment opportunities for them, we pushed for a model that, you know, organized youth groups would then be trained by NARO and given startup, you know, mother gardens, taught how to, you know, pot the seedlings, multiply them, and sell, do business.
All okay? this stuff.
Yes. So in the project districts, I'll use one project district which I just visited before the closure of USAID. That was in Tungamo. I visited a young man who had just got out of university, based in a sub-county called Chibasi. He had left the city and said, hey, I found a business opportunity back home. His father gave him a little piece of land, and he's one of the main suppliers now of the new varieties of coffee seedlings. The other is a farmer in another sub-county in Tungamo. I visited him just before the closure, called Namara James in Tungamo. This farmer, I think this year, should be able to make over 60 million Uganda shillings from the sale of coffee seedlings. He's receiving buyers from all over the southwestern part of the country, you know? So business model that works out, even when we phase out, somebody's making money, is doing it as a business. Okay, yeah.
Did your phone stop ringing, or are there some of the teams you're working with, or...
Yeah, even right now, this as I came into the waiting room here, some of the phone calls still keep coming in. Say, hey, are you there? We're still asking about this. Can we still continue to? But then, you know, the stop work order, the farmer may not understand what exactly that meant.
It just feels like you abandoned them.
No, but the good thing is that, so when you take a trainer of trainers model, then there's always somebody on ground.
There's a bit of continuity.
Like these farmers that we did train and build the capacity for them to keep producing these climate smart technologies, they still continue to. But also, having worked through the government institutions, we're able to say, hey, look, check with NARO. NARO will continue to exist even without US government funding. Yeah.
So I'm sure I know the answer to this one, but just to check, is the funding now at totally zero, or did it just dramatically reduce?
So I'll respond to that question based on the portfolio I managed, the climate and biodiversity conservation portfolio. So the funding is zeroed out.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you see as the long-term effects of this zero funding?
So, again, this depends on if there's somebody else
picking up.
Possibly picking up from where we stopped.
Is there anyone picking up?
So again, since January, I've not been able to, for example, participate in development partners meetings because the rule of the game was that as staff, we were no longer allowed to continue to participate in some of those meetings to represent the U.S. government on those meetings. So on the development partners side, I can't tell very clearly if there's somebody picking up from where we stopped. But my expectation is that especially the government partners like NARO, like the Wildlife Authority, like the National Forestry Authority, the other ministries we engaged with, like MAIF, we kept encouraging them to, you know, include budgetary provisions in their next, you know, annual plans and budgets for the kind of work that we had been doing together. So the chances are likely that, yes, there's continuity, especially for government. But to answer your first question, if what the kind of impact
long term
would be like if nobody picked up, obviously it would be adverse impact in terms of food security for our population, adverse impact in terms of water supplies, adverse impact in terms of health, because we were making lots of investments in the health sector, climate-related ones through our mainstreaming work, or even direct investments like indoor residual spraying and So the long-term impact goes beyond the day-to-day livelihoods, but to the overall well-being of the people and of course, adverse implications for general development and the economy in general.
I recently interviewed someone who was sharing their own experience. They were speaking of the silence that followed. They had applied for a grant. They'd gone, you know, a couple of steps and then just silence. And for them, out of all of this is the clear understanding that we need to stop heavily relying on donor funding and governments need to step up and private sector needs to step up. What are your thoughts?
I totally agree with their thinking. I think that's the way to go. This was a big lesson for us. But as I did mention to you, we'd already been through our own projects, been encouraging that, hey, look, let's try to have the private sector come into this kind of work that we do. Especially look out for those components that make a business sense, make business sense to the private sector. But also for the government to begin stepping up, increasing their portion of investment in some of these works, some of these investments. I purely agree with their thinking that let's stop depending on development partners 100%. By the time of closure, actually, we had begun to build the capacity of local organizations to take lead in the kind of works that we were doing. You will notice that, for example, in the health sector, most of the monies were now beginning to go to local organizations. We were taking a localization approach. You know, rather than engage the big U.S. companies to come and implement the contracts here, we were beginning to award the contracts to local organizations, build their capacity to begin to do that kind of work. And that's the way to go. Build the capacity. And in the climate change space, additionally, what we are doing through our projects, we are also building the human resource capacity. So you don't have to bring experts from elsewhere to respond to, you know, climate change in Uganda. One example was is that project I talked about with the IITA. So we were funding about 18 PhDs and MSCs, you know?
So many acronyms.
Yeah, sorry?
So many acronyms.
The IITA, the International Institute for Tropical Agriculture, that project with IIT and NARO. I think NARO is much more familiar.
You can't assume that everybody...
The National Agricultural Research Organization. And then, so through that program, we're supporting so many masters and PhD programs in climate research and science so that we could build, you know, that local capacity, the human resource that the country needs to respond to climate change being a new science, you know, but also the new MSc climate change at Makerere University. We supported the development of that program so that locally here, you know, many more scientists can venture into climate science for us to be able to build the much needed human capacity, human resource capacity to respond. Yeah. So correct, building our own internal capacities and less dependence on donor support is the way to go.
When I listen to you speaking, and even from our previous conversation, what I get is that part of your job was to make sure that USAID-funded projects were being implemented efficiently.
Correct.
And that the money wasn't being wasted. But then there's this whole USAID is inefficient propaganda machine, that all of this that was going out and how the money was being spent and all of the receipts that people are pulling out.
Yeah.
Was that hurtful for you?
Of course, that was so hurting. Having been internally there, it's easy for people who are not within the system themselves to make such comments. But the truth is, so USAID had these very strong checks and balances internally to control against any kind of fraud, waste, and abuse, right from project design, inbuilt systems, you know? And then we also had the U.S. Inspector General of Government based here for USAID activities, for USAID projects, you know, full-time watchdog. So the internal systems against any kind of fraud, waste, and abuse provided for, you know, reporting, investigation, and even termination where any kind of fraud, waste, and abuse had been found. And believe me, Josephine, even for my own projects that I oversaw, I don't want to mention company names here, but I'm aware of companies whose contracts were terminated because of detected, you know, where fraud, waste, and abuse was detected. It would be embarrassing for me to mention. There are about three local companies whose contracts were terminated.
And your overview of USAID and its systems is Ugandan-based?
So these are global requirements for the entire agency. Yeah, systems inbuilt into how the agency does things. And we had to do that also for Uganda.
Yeah. So you said since January is when you received the
stop work order.
What have you been doing since January? Am I allowed to ask that question?
Should be fine.
All right. What have you been doing since January up to June when you were then said, when you know you now you know that this is over and done with?
Yeah. So to close projects is a very lengthy process, actually more than the 6 months that we were given. It's so lengthy to close a project. You know, there are lots of assets on ground, there are a number of contractors on ground, so many things that are incomplete, you know? So many things. If I'm to tell you the things that stayed halfway incomplete, you wouldn't believe. You know, you have equipment on ground. You have to work with the implementing partners to develop asset disposition plans. You know, you have to evaluate how much they need to be compensated so far for how much work they had delivered on ground. you know, you have to calculate staff benefits. So many staff are going to lose their jobs, but, you know, there are so many different provisions in their contracts that you have to review and be able to determine how much they need to be paid, you know? Yeah, so closure processes, you know, reviewing some of those claims and making sure they are rightfully paid for.
You know, in my head, you know, Robert, the stop work order meant put your pens down, go home.
Yeah, but then somebody has to be paid. And also, you're not just going to leave government equipment on ground. You have to bring them back either to Kampala or identify, you know, whom you should deposit this to. You need to transfer, work with the Ministry of Works and Transport, if it's a vehicle, to transfer ownership from the U.S. government name.
So there's a lot of operational work.
Lots of operational works, financial related and, you know, other. Yeah.
What would you like us to know about all of this, how it's played out, how we should perceive it?
I think from my previous submissions, I've said a lot about how it played out. You know, it all happened so fast, so drastic. We possibly weren't able to do certain things like we'd have wished to do them, you know, smooth handover and smooth transition. That would have been our wish. But we tried our best during the available time, engaged with our partners, especially the government partners and other development partners who would wish to pick up from where we stopped. We provided the documentation, but also did the transitions, you know, to the other U.S. government agencies, provided all the information. If somebody would wish to pick up from where we stopped, you know, the State Department is still in place. They can approach State Department and pick it up from there. And especially for the donor community, the development partners. For the works that stopped midway, those present low-hanging fruits, opportunities for them to pick up from there. You know, I'll give you examples of construction works. A building stops midway.
Yeah.
You know, you want to pick it up from there, complete the structure, and then...
So when you pull away, when USAID pulls away and there's this building midway, they just...
That is exactly where the construction work stops.
There's a guy
clear examples that just exist.
Walking through empty construction sites and saying, yep, this is where they left this. And I kept thinking, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's what stop work orders meant. If, you know, you're doing construction, that is where you stop. So clear examples, you'll find them when you go to Kidepo National Park. We are doing lots of construction works there. Three new ranger outposts for rangers to increase their deployment, to conserve the landscape. Lots of water supply schemes, you know, stream crossings across the park. Everything stopped where it was. And so that's how I'm saying these present low-hanging fruits not only for the development partners, but also for government, the Wildlife Authority, the Forest Authority. We were, for the Forest Authority, we were constructing. So we had just completed the designs and, you know, the environmental assessments for the first ever canopy walk in Uganda for Kalinzu, you know, and possibly the third in Africa. One in Rwanda, one in Ghana, also previously supported by USAID. About a $2 million investment that had to stop where we had. And so those, the canopy walk and visitor center, those present low-hanging fruits for the private sector. NFA to engage with the private sector, you know, for tourists to come from all over the world to this, be able to do chimp trekking over a canopy walk. And the aim is that if communities can realize the benefits from such an investment, then they'll protect the forest reserve. And then, you know, it continues to sequester carbon. Yeah.
I have two more questions for you and then I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps you awake now?
Can you clarify keeping awake as
at night? Generally about the state of affairs, about your work on climate, for yourself?
For myself. So right now, for me, I look at the positive side of it. One, the closure presents an opportunity for me to get back to my own work, private work, you know, but also family time. Many times I've kept away from family for so
You're
long, for so
too
many
much.
Years. Lots of travel, and but also I'd been an absentee farmer. You know, the things we teach other people to do, you know,
yes.
climate smart and new coffee varieties.
When
and
you're on...
So on my own farm, you know, absentee farmer,
yeah.
things are not working out so well. So look at it, I'm looking at it positively, using part of the time to do that. So it's keeping me awake. But two, at the time of closure, I was picking a lot of interest in climate finance. So I'm doing a lot of reading, a lot of discussion with the professors and others in the climate finance space. I'm one of those people that believe that, to respond to climate change internally within our country, we don't have to all the time look at foreign funding. So trying to, do research and explore those opportunities for domestic climate financing. Mm. It's an area of interest for me. It keeps me awake, Josephine.
You know, my next question was going to say, what gives you hope? But then I feel like you...
Yeah, I think I've answered that.
You're good.
Yeah, especially through... If we took the mainstreaming approach, these resources we already have for all these other sectors... Support these sectors to be able to do climate risk analysis on an annual basis. Okay? The health sector, for example, should be able to identify climate risks to the health sector. Pick part of the budgetary provisions on an annual basis and say, hey, look, we can actually use these resources. Same applies to all the other sectors. And I think that's the way to go. It will reduce dependence on foreign sources of climate financing.
Robert, with all of the work that you did, which of it is going to or is hurting you the most now that you don't have to go back to it? Where had you made so much progress? Where did you see so much potential and you're concerned about what the future of it looks like?
Two main things are most hurting to me that they had to stop midway. One is the conservation works that stopped midway. The conservation works that involved, especially the construction works that were meant to support the law enforcement agencies to build their capacity to protect those landscapes that sequester carbon dioxide, including, building the ranger outposts, but also erecting concrete pillars around central forest reserves to increase their protection status. But three, the canopy walk, the tourism facility that we had planned for the Kalinzu. Very hurting. Those works, I would be happy if somebody could pick them up and then, continue and accomplish those, because the potential was really huge to support conservation work in the country, but also increase chances for sequestering carbon in the country. But two, within the Kidepo landscape, we'd just completed feasibility studies for a carbon credit scheme for that landscape. We found it very feasible. And we had now engaged Okavango Capital, an international company with experience in developing carbon credit schemes. They were now developing that scheme to readiness levels for buyers of those carbon credits to begin to come in. And we were looking at this scheme as one opportunity for government then to test the new guidelines for regulating carbon trade in the country. We were looking at it as an opportunity to partner with the Climate Change Department of the Ministry of Water and Environment to test these new guidelines. So I really pray and look forward to any opportunity for either government itself or other development partners to pick up on this scheme, you know, under development and complete its development and you know, give the opportunity for the landowners to benefit from, you know, carbon trade.
It's a lot to explain carbon trade to landowners, to smallholder farmers. So you've done all this explanation, all this work, and then they get nothing.
Yeah, it stops midway. You know, you've raised all the expectations
My second question is on all this research that you'd done, all the information about how far projects had gone and, you know, where they're stuck.
Yeah.
Where do people find it? If I need to build on what you've been doing, I'm an interested partner or something, where do I find the information? When I visit the site, I find it's locked.
All right. So two main sources. One, for the government partners that we were working with, I'll give you an example of the Wildlife Authority or the National Forestry Authority. You know, research studies, environment assessments, the designs for the construction works, we did hand these over. But two, project-related information, everything. July 1st was the transition date to State Department, July 1st. We made sure all this information was transitioned to State Department. So you can find that information if you contacted the State Department.
Unless you have anything else to tell me, Robert?
Nothing else. Just to say that on a private basis, I will be available. Anybody that will need that kind of support or continuity in these kind of discussions, I think I'll have much more time.
Climate finance, agriculture.
And biodiversity conservation.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Robert, for taking the time. This has been really insightful to see what it actually meant and looked like when all of these things were happening. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. And thanks for the invitation too.